The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. Reggie Mobley has been a member of the Grammy-nominated ensemble Seraphic Fire and has performed with top ensembles all over the world, including the Academy of Ancient Music, Monteverdi Choir, and English Baroque Soloists, the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, Seattle Symphony, the Handel and Haydn Society, and at numerous festivals across the globe. He's also working with Agave Baroque on a recording of American originals featuring Baroque composers born in the Americas, along with works of late 19th and early 20th century African-American composers Florence Price and Justin Holland. Reggie Mobley joins me via Zoom to talk about some of the many projects he is working on. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So I'm starting all of my interviews during this crazy time with just kind of touching base and asking, how are you doing in this time of COVID-19? How are things going for you?
Like I tell everyone, I'm doing fine, but fine with an asterisk. So it's a qualified fine that I think everyone is going through at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Fine being, I'm not currently ill. I'm not currently unhoused. I am plenty fed. So, and I have tons of streaming services to keep me occupied. So it's fine.
Good. That's good. That's good. So you're a singer, but a little bird told me that you thought you would have a career as a visual artist using watercolors and pastels. What's that all about? How'd you get started making music instead?
Well, I've always been around music. I definitely, I sang in the church choir growing up and in middle and high school and throughout parts of college, of course, eventually. I was a trumpet player.
Oh.
I played keyboards as well. My high school in Florida, Gainesville, Florida, where I grew up, was a drafting and architecture magnet school. And so I went into the drafting and architecture program as well when I got to my high school, and then added art courses. And I became more and more infatuated with art. I was in, actually by my senior year, I was in including a chorus class, a keyboard class, a drafting class, two AP art courses, and then what general coursework I had left in high school. I passed the exam and ended up with a scholarship, Davidson College in North Carolina. At that time, I really started to fall out of love with visual arts as falling out of love with the idea of making my career in visual arts or perhaps even architecture. And I was becoming more and more interested in music. And I was also developing some issues with carpal tunnel syndrome in my right hand and right wrist. And so we were able to, with my mother's insistence, we were able to find a college, HBCU and Oakwood College, which is also affiliated with the Seventh Day Adventist Church, of which I was raised. And they were willing to match my scholarship. So they matched my art scholarship for music. And so I was able to say, no, thank you, Davidson, but I'm going to go to Huntsville instead, and went to Oakwood. And it was an immediate left turn and went to school on a trumpet scholarship. And
wow.
I don't think I played trumpet one day. I immediately started singing, went straight into voice.
How did you find the range that you are singing in, though? How did you find your way to that?
Oh, that was not until much later, until I ended up back in Florida, at University of Florida, where I sang in a barbershop quartet. And I sang the top tenor part, which is typically in that almost alto range. Well, it's in an alto range, basically, but it just depends on how you sing it. And I was using my head voice and my falsetto to sing in that tenor part, the top part of a barbershop quartet. And my professor at the time happened to hear me and our quartet singing in the common area at the music building at University of Florida. And he took me to his office and basically terrified me and made me sing through some scales up the octave as opposed to in the typical weird baritone range that most young men would sing. And he basically just looked at me, stared at me and said, "You're a countertenor. This is what you are." And I, being this wide-eyed, you know, 19, 20-year-old kid, of course said, "That's great. What's a countertenor?" And he, you know, he told me and we went from there. He said, "When you come back to your lesson next week, this is what you'll be doing and most likely doing for the rest of your life." And I have not proven him wrong yet, but there's still some time. I'm only 42.
So why don't you give your explanation of what a countertenor is? Because I think people don't necessarily know what that means and what, you know, what exactly you have to do to get to that.
Well, there are many ways to get to it, but basically a countertenor is a male alto or a man who sings in the alto range, so right below soprano and above tenor, which typically most people who sing in maybe, you know, in choirs or have a rudimentary knowledge of singing or choral singing, typically the alto part is female. So typically soprano and alto are women and the tenors and basses are men. And there's always some variation one way or the other, but the countertenor basically sings in that alto range and sometimes soprano. It's basically a kind of a marriage of the head and falsetto voice to create an extended range above your modal or chest voice, whatever that may be. And I happen to fit right in the alto range. Of course, there are many countertenors who sing coloratura soprano. There are some who are mezzos. There are some who are, you know, who have the range of a lyric soprano. So, I mean, it's countertenor is actually more of a category than just a specific voice classification. It covers the entire spectrum of that upper range from soprano through alto. And that's what I do. It had been more common for men to sing the alto part, you know, pre mid 19th century. Most church choirs in Europe were usually boys and are castrati, and then male tenors and basses. And of course, in the opera stages in the Baroque period, that you would often find castrati and are men who sang in falsetto. And so it only up until the late 19th century did the idea of men typically singing the alto part or women singing in choirs at all, did that really change. Mm-hmm. And so we're kind of bringing it back.
So do you have any favorite roles to sing? Do you have favorite composers?
I am, if anyone knows me, they know me, I'm the big Bach guy. So whatever there is, it's Bach. I will sing Bach. Yeah. So Bach and Bach. As far as roles, I typically don't do a lot of opera. I'm not really that interested in opera. There are plenty of people who love it. And so that doesn't have to be me. I could be the guy that loves the other stuff. So I'm happiest singing cantatas or motets or, you know, various, you know, solo works. But if you can call being a soloist in an oratorio or a passion a role, then that's the role I would typically sing. I mean, and of course, I guess I would include oratorio as well. So I do, you know, sing a lot of Handel oratorio and whatnot, and those are always fun. I would say if there is a role that I do enjoy singing, I guess the role in Jephthah. Hamor is a really fun one. Michal in Samson is also a great one. All the Handel Oratorios have great roles for the alto, for which cantors sing.
Yeah. So you've been working and actually traveling, like actually traveling, yes, a lot. One of the many current projects you have is a recording with Agave Baroque American Originals. Talk a little bit about what is on this recording and also when is it going to be released?
In reverse order, I don't know. I typically try not to involve myself with too much of the technical side of things. But hopefully we would say maybe, if not the end of the year, sometime in the new year, hopefully we'll see that released. But this is based off of a concert that we, Agave, that we did, performed this past January at the Tucson Song Festival. And we put together a program of, because Agave is typically a period group. And of course, me being a counter trainer, we had a lot of early stuff. We were digging into basically Latin Baroque music, our Latinx Baroque, Hispanic Baroque. So composers that are, we try to just really just deal with composers who are indigenous to the Americas. So composers like Manuel Zumaya, a couple of anonymous pieces from Peru and Bolivia. I think there might have been Padilla on the program in January. And then also a couple of pieces by Esteban Salas, who is the Cuban Baroque composer that should be a household name. He's incredible. So we did that, and then we balanced the half with the works of Black composers, so also indigenous American composers at that point. So Justin Holland, Scott Joplin, and then of course Florence Price. And we, in the album, we'll be adding a few different composers. I believe we're adding William Grant Still, and I think we'll be adding something else. But the idea of it being American Originals is that this program is a disc of incredible music by incredible composers, none of whom happen to be white. And it's the idea that these are all incredible composers who are just happen to be people of color, but are definitely American originals. Like they are of this continent of America. And so we hope to kind of really show the beauty and depth and wonder of all of these, you know, non-white composers of, you know, from the 17th century to now, to kind of also, in a way, hope to un-whitewash music history. We kind of fall back or lazily just think that, you know, Black and brown composers didn't really show up until the 20th century. That no Black person ever thought to write a note until, you know, Dvorak found Harry Burley in the American Conservatory. And that couldn't be further from the truth. People of color, women, female composers, queer composers, like we've been part of music history, you know, and in many ways the backbone of music history, and for as long as there has been, you know, composed music, we've always been a part in some way or another. And it's time that we now stop thinking of everything before the 20th century as, you know, dead cis white, you know, straight male composers who may or may not have been in powdered wigs. So we're really bringing, you know, bringing back music in Technicolor this time.
Yeah.
And it should also work to another point of that is that we want to show people of color who are interested in music that they do have a place because they've always had a place. It's all about also furthering representation. Like when you think of musicologists, most musicologists are typically white men, are straight white men. And there's no need to really dig into the details and nuance of what a composer or a musician was, except for it being incidental. They can focus on just the music and the merit of it because they have no issue with being represented. They don't have to think about seeing themselves in the composers that they dig up and research and talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully this album will help to kind of strike a blow against the notion that people that look like me and you were kind of background figures
mm-hmm.
in the goings on in music
mm-hmm.
throughout, you know, the past few centuries or so or more.
Right. More, you know, in some ways more lacking access to be able to, you know, get out there. You didn't write the history books in a sense, right? And that's a very big part of your career too, just this whole idea of making it a priority to make a difference within the arts with these massive inequalities within classical music. Do you have any, you know, other thoughts, not only in relation to this wonderful recording, but also just more in general about, you know, kind of where things stand and where you hope to see things go?
I just hope people put their money where their statements are. Since the further and continuing tragic deaths and murders of Black people by police, and just by this system that stands in this country, you know, so many corporations and arts orgs and groups have gotten together and finally said, enough is enough. Black lives matter. We want to see a change. It's time to make a change. And they all seemingly wanted to do something. And in some cases, changes have started to take place. But unfortunately, in the arts, it's, you know, the cement's kind of cooled a bit and nothing's been done. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate, you know, the sentiment from all of these, you know, these groups and arts orgs and so forth, but it's time to put your money where your statement is. It's time to actually hire Black. It's time to actually program Black. It's time to actually, you know, share and this power that you've been holding on to. You can't talk about and expect diversity to just happen on its own because you think it's a cool idea. If you really want to change the structure to what it should be, to be more equitable, to grant more parity, then you have to be willing to also give up your own consolidated power. And that includes everyone. It's not just waiting for someone down the road or someone in New York to do it. It's also for you to start doing it. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping to see people actually take charge and do these things. Because I feel like actually there are fewer Black people in the arts who expect changes to happen because this has happened before. You know, the statements have been made before, the solidarity has been said before, and that time has passed, and that time has passed, and that time has passed, and nothing's been done. Mm-hmm. So there's not a lot of trust out there. And I think it's finally time that the trust is earned. That we can only run up and try to kick the football so many more times before we learn. And I think many of us have learned, and so it's time to actually put up and change.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Make the change, please. That's all I'm hoping for. That's all I'm working towards. That's all I can ask for.
And I will say that this recording, this Agave Baroque recording, is something that I really look forward to. It's a wonderful gift to be able to have something with very high quality performers with really special repertory to be able to disseminate, you know, I mean, that is a real gift to be able to get as a broadcaster and as a listener, to be able to hear it and appreciate it and enjoy it. And also to be able to say, you know, here it is. This is the proof. It's beautiful and it is every bit as worthy, you know.
Every bit as worthy.
Yeah.
And I won't say that every note written by a black or brown composer, written by a female composer, written by a queer composer, is, you know, oral manna. Like, it's not everything is the greatest thing in the world. No, of course not. You know, but the thing is, yes, you know, and people have made this argument before. They're like, well, you know, Ignacio Sancho or Nunez Garcia, well, he's not Bach, or, well, you know, Xavier Saint-Georges, he's not Mozart. Well, neither is Hummel. Neither is, you know, neither is Telemann. Neither is, you know, but they get plenty of time. We seem to hold the music of non-white composers to this higher standard that they have to, of course, work twice as hard and be twice as good to be accepted on the same level as what we just typically listen to. And yet we don't hold that same standard to, you know, to less impressive white composers. So there's a weird subconscious bias that we have to work to overcome as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, even though we did, you know, we picked some of the best out there to record, that doesn't mean that the rest of it shouldn't be performed and recorded either. It's just as worthy.
Right. So I want to go back a little bit into a different area of your very active performing career, and that's Handel and Haydn Society. You are really very involved with their, you know, their productions. What kind of roles? You have a number of different roles with Handel and Haydn Society. Could you talk a little bit about that?
I, of course, do sing with H&H. When I first moved to Boston, I did a couple of contracts, projects where I sang in the chorus at the very beginning. That was before I really branched out as a soloist. And then I took some time off. And actually, before I came back as a soloist, I came back as a director during the bicentennial celebration for H&H, which in 2015, which was also the sesquicentennial anniversary of the end of the Civil War, there was a partnership between H&H and the Museum of African American History in Boston. MAAH found all these past records, and H&H at the same time also found their peanut butter and their chocolate, and they kind of came together and said, oh, look at this shared history that we have. H&H in the 1860s, 1850s and 1860s were full of abolitionists and anti-slavery activists. I mean, it was a coven of abolitionists. And Julia Ward Howe, who wrote the Battle Hymn of Republic, sang in the H&H chorus in that time. Her and her husband, like, there was a group of them that apparently travel down to D.C. to be part of the group that lobbied and helped convince President Lincoln to emancipate the slaves instead of repatriating, because repatriation would have been a complete disaster. So when the emancipation was ratified, and then when the amendment freeing the slaves was ratified, H&H had a massive rally on concert, you know, that December 31 that led in, you know, that led into the new year, you know, the ratification on Jan 1 to celebrate these things. So, like, there was always this energy and fervor and drive towards equality at that time. And H&H, you know, time moved on, but in recent times, seeing all of this history kind of reinvigorated and reinstilled a desire and almost onus to be a part of the community, and not just a part of, you know, the white community or the, you know, the upper class Brahmin community, but to be a part of the community of Boston, which, by the way, is not just a white community. Boston's 53% person of color. It's actually a truly diverse city. And so H&H is with, you know, with the concert I did with them, we started this partnership where we just really sought to showcase the music of black composers and work towards bringing music and culture, not just bringing in a few Black kids from various schools to sit in Symphony Hall and feel awkward, but to put ourselves in the community, because mm-hmm. we don't belong to just one bit of Back Bay, H&H, and more than that, music itself belongs to everyone. And so it's our duty to reintegrate ourselves into the community, and that's what we hope to do, especially with the work that I do as a director. We, of course, found out after that concert in 2015 that I ended up being the first Black person to ever direct H&H, which was really cool, and kind of sad as well. but they realized that this change needed to happen, and I was happy to take up the baton, take up the pen, and start to do the work and help them do the work. And we've hit the ground running. We've had a successful partnership with the Unitarian Universalist Urban Mission in Roxbury, mm-hmm. just around the corner from me. And we've had a wonderful relationship for several years now, doing concerts in the community at First Church in Roxbury. We've partnered with other churches in the area, and we're working more and more to bring a lot of our concerts into other various diverse parts of Boston to reintegrate ourselves. And as of this year, with the hats I'm already wearing, they created the role of programming consultant for me so that I could do the work to help actually change the main subscription series as well. The idea of that role is that it's time to stop rotating the same four dead, bewinged composers over and over and over, but to show off that depth of sex and gender and color and all those things that existed back then. So we'll be bringing more and more composers of color and female composers and queer composers to the main concert series with H&H, starting very soon. And that's something I'm really excited about. And I know that hopefully it'll be meaningful to the community to be able to go, not just... in addition to us coming to them, when they do come to Symphony Hall or Jordan Hall in the future and sit down to hear their Mozart concerto, they will also hear that St. George concerto. They will also hear that Beethoven or, Haydn Mass, as well as the Salas Mass, one of his Masses or Requiems, and hear, and just hearing something of Isabel Leonarda or, Duarte, Cozzolani, just like really showing off how wonderful these composers are. And of course, maybe finally accepting the existence of queer composers who we already do know. It's time to actually accept the idea that Handel is one of our queer composers, and Schubert and Corelli and just really kind of putting the people back into the musician, making the composer human again, and start treating them like gods are marble statues on pedestals. Mm-hmm. It's time to make them people, because it's the human element that makes music alive, that makes music music. And it's us that are moved by the power of music. So it's time to, to make it happen, to make it real.
Yeah. I can't think of a better way to wrap up this conversation. Those are very poignant and very powerful words, actually, Reggie. I've been speaking with countertenor Reggie Mobley, who is a very busy musician and a very active recording artist, who will be coming out with a recording called American Originals with Agave Baroque sometime in 2021. And we look forward to hearing that. Thank you very much. Congratulations on all of these amazing projects. And thank you so much for making time to speak with me.
Thank you. Thank you.